Today I want to zoom in. We're going to start our actual study of the book of Ruth, and that's going to have to begin by zooming out a little bit from what we read last week. Back in November, Bushnell University hosted a three-day seminar on the book of Ruth. It was hosted led by one of the leading Old Testament scholars in the world, a woman named Dr. Sandra Richter, and Pastor Joshua and myself and Amber Riggs all were lucky enough to be able to go to that 3 days to dive in deeply into this book. And so for the next 4 weeks, we're going to preach through it based on our findings and research and leaning heavily on Dr. Richter's insights. So I think you guys are going to enjoy this. It's one of these books that gets more intriguing and interesting as you zoom in more and more. It's a powerful book. It is not a book. It's not a women's book. Okay, so guys, trust me. Just hang with us. It is a powerful book for everybody. So we're gonna do a deep dive, but not too deep because we don't have that much time. But let's begin. We're gonna dive right in, chapter one this morning, with a specific focus on the character of Naomi. Okay, Ruth 1, verse 1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah who went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife was Naomi. Okay, where are we? Let's pull up a map here to give some quick perspective. Here's a Mediterranean world, and we zoom in way to the point. You can zoom in so close that everything looks pixelated when you're there. It's really crazy. And we replace it with a map here. You can see Jerusalem and Bethlehem are on the west side of the Dead Sea, and Moab is on the other side. So in order to get there, they would have had to travel around. That's approximately 50 miles. It's very rugged, rough terrain. It would have taken on foot a week or more. So that's where they went. And when are we? We have a timeline. Very cool. We are in the days of the judges, which means during the events of the book of Judges. That means after Charlton Heston as Moses there. Some of you guys don't even know what that's from, but that's Moses. And before the more appropriate statue of King David. There's a couple of them. I chose wisely. The period of the judges is this time in between, okay? So that means it's been hundreds of years since Abraham. Israel's not yet a kingdom. It's more a loosely connected group of tribes. There's no kings yet. And it's a very tumultuous time. Now, it's been hundreds of years since Father Abraham. And since God had made a covenant with Abraham, saying, I'm going to make of you a great nation, I'm going to bless all the families of the earth through you. And of course, it's going to happen through Jesus in about 1,000 years or so. But even before then, they're called to be a blessing to all the nations of the world, even before Christ. And the way they're to do that is to show the world what God is actually like. Now, the problem is, up until this time, they have not done a particularly good job of that. In fact, this part in their history is very, very dark. We can pull that timeline down. The book of Judges is rated R at best, okay? Here's basically what happens all the way through the book of Judges. Israel keeps failing their mission to show the world what God's like. They keep rebelling against God, going into idolatry. Another nation comes in and is on the verge of like destroying them. Then they cry out to God, and God raises up, we call him a judge, but really more like almost like a warlord, like Gideon or Samson or Deborah. And he raises them up, and they come in and they conquer that nation, push them back, and everyone's like, woo, thank God, well, I'm glad that's over. Hey, let's do that again. And they just keep going. It's a cycle, and it gets really bad. Now, they get so depraved in this time that the last like quarter of this book is terrible. Like, there should be a parental lock on the end of Judges. It's extreme. The story ends with one. The book ends with one expanded story that involves, it begins with awful sexual violence against a woman, then murder, and then dismemberment, and war, and kidnapping, and human trafficking, and the near elimination of an entire tribe of Israel, which is the tribe of Benjamin. It is awful. And the book ends with these words. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. A chilling last line. Now, in the middle of that mess, we have this quiet little story of Naomi and Ruth. And the contrast is nearly miraculous. So, in this story, despite my previous jokes, this is not a Francine Rivers book. This is not a rom-com. The Book of Ruth is not a rom-com. It's honestly not even really a rom. It's not actually a romance. That's the way that we've read it, but I think that's the way, because we haven't really understood it very well. It's a story of extreme poverty and survival, and in order to understand it, we have to cross a bit of a cultural gap. Have you guys ever had to cross a cultural gap before? Dr. Richter says that a lot of us experience our first cultural gap when we have like a slumber party as a kid with somebody else. And you're like, these people are weird, man. We used to have a family that would come to visit us, and we had a big family, but they had a really big family, and we never liked it when this family came over. They were mean, and they didn't like to watch football, and we couldn't understand that. Like, what's wrong with you? They wanted to watch baseball. I'm like, okay, baseball, all right, but football, you know? And so it was weird, but they at least played football with us. But I'll never forget the moment that we realized we were very, very, very different. See, my brothers and I, a play had just ended. We put the ball down. We went back to huddle for the next play. And all of a sudden, we see them pick up the football and run past us and say, touchdown, woohoo! And we're going, what are you doing? The play was over. And they said, you didn't lock the ball. You didn't say, ball's locked. We're like, balls. I have watched football for a really, really long time. But I had never come across this particular cultural rule that was in their house. You didn't say, ball's locked. And I was thinking about that phrase. Like, it's like a great, like, cultural gap phrase, right? You realize these people are different. Now, that's obviously a silly, very light example of a cultural gap. Now, we're sending some of our young people this summer to Central America, where the gap will be bigger. There's a language gap. There's all kinds of things the culture is going to do different. And they'll have somebody sit down with them and talk about things that are maybe normal for them, that are not going to be normal for the people they're talking to. They'll have to get a bit of a primer on their culture. We need a little bit of that here for ancient Israelite culture, okay, in order to get this book. So I'm going to talk through just a little bit of it. I want to start with the big picture here. You and I live in a bureaucratic culture. In our culture, the state is what connects pretty much everything, okay? All of our society, the state is sort of in the middle. If we break the law, well, the police come to us, right? We might see a judge, we might go to jail. If we have a fire, we call emergency services, and we have people who know how to put out fires and have really great equipment to do so come and help us with that. If we lose our job, there's a thing called unemployment. There's also other sorts of safety nets and benefits like food stamps or EBT cards, you know, all kinds of things we have. In our modern culture, the state is there and it's kind of the connecting piece. And even when it's not the state, there's other agencies that step up. Even locally, we have local aid. We have Catholic services. We have churches. We have the Eugene Mission, all of those kinds of things. That's a bureaucratic culture. Israel, however, you didn't have any of this. None of it. It's not a bureaucratic culture. It's a patriarchal tribal culture, which is very, very different. In a tribal culture, none of that is available. There are no safety nets, okay? The state is nowhere to be seen. Nonprofit orgs are nowhere to be seen. That means there's no police to come if somebody's trying to break into your home. There's no firefighters. There's no food stamps. There's no unemployment insurance. There's no charities. You're entirely dependent on the tribe, and that starts with the patriarch of the family to take care of you. Now, who is this patriarch? Well, the patriarch is your oldest male relative, okay? He has to take care of anyone, not just his wife and young kids, but also his older kids who are now married and have their kids, and all of those people. So you have multiple generations that all live in the same family compound. They call it the Bet Av, which is in the father's house. You would have a lot of different rooms in the father's house, and all these people would be living together. It was in this family compound, it was a lot of work, a lot of very essential work. The men would be out doing the farming every single day. They would be working with a wooden plow and an ox. It was very difficult work. The women would also be doing very difficult work all day long. They'd be making garments, for example. Clothes are so cheap and inexpensive. I think we don't have any idea how different this is. It would take 10 weeks to make a single garment back then. So it was very precious, very expensive. It took hours to make a single loaf of bread. Food was not abundant. We have a picture of the land there, fields in Bethlehem. This is, you know, we're not looking at the Willamette Valley. We're not looking at the lush green, everything sprouts up easily. This was a difficult place to be a farmer, to have this kind of responsibility. So the generations lived together and worked hard for their own survival. Women were particularly vulnerable in this day and age because they had no civil land rights at all. They had to find a man. We can pull that down now. And we're not talking about romance. Romance, who has time for romance? This is not even in the picture. A woman had to find a man who could take care of her and whatever children she was going to have. This is all about survival. She must produce sons to let the family line continue. And there had to be a man then who could take her in, who could give her the protection of the households, as well as provide. That was the only way she was going to survive. So this is a really tough, the ancient world is a very, very tough place to be a woman or to be poor. Now, finding a husband, that's one thing, and generally, this wouldn't be the big issue because, you know, fortunately, most places you go, it's going to be about 50-50 population, so except in times of war and things like that. So finding a husband wasn't the huge thing. The big problem is, what if your husband died? What do you do then? What do you do if what happens to your children? Because she has no access to any sort of civil safety nets, as we said, tribal society. She has no rights. She's completely she's completely vulnerable, and it's only the immediate family that can step in to help. And if they can't, then maybe the larger plan, the larger clan. Now, there was one scenario, especially for widows in this society, okay? And this is going to be a big culture gap, all right? It's a thing called levirate marriage. Levirate marriage. Here's how it worked. Ladies, put yourself here. Imagine you're living in this culture and your husband dies. This is very traumatic. Even if you hadn't loved him, it would still be extremely traumatic because that means, oh no, this is desperate. I have no way to continue on. I now... Okay, maybe I can enter into this thing. And here's how it would work. You're the patriarch in your family. That means your father-in-law was still alive, he would be the patriarch probably. He would bring you in by giving you as a wife to your brother-in-law. Even if your brother-in-law was already married. Okay? This was the provision. Your brother's or your husband's little brother, he's married, he's doing great, and suddenly he's like, you're gonna go and become his second wife. And then you would then continue to live in the family compound, in the Bet Av, but you would have the protection of the family, and he would treat you as a wife in all the ways. So if you had children, he now is responsible for the children. And he has to raise those children in the name of his dead brother. If he didn't have children, it was his responsibility to provide children. Okay? So in all of the ways. And those kids would then be in the name of, would continue in the lineage of his late brother. Are you with me still? Okay. That again, she would then be protected, and then the children would be able to go on and have some sustenance. Now, ladies, what do you think of that arrangement? I was wondering about what my dear wife thinks of that arrangement. I have four brothers. You'll be in good hands. Right? So that is a culture gap moment, isn't it? It was a culture gap moment. That's a balls locked moment, is it not? Now I'm guessing most of you don't love that idea, but this is just how tribal societies worked. Long before the law of Moses, okay? In fact, if you want to get a really clear picture of this, there's another very rated R story in Genesis chapter 38 with Judah and Tamar. You guys remember this story? It is a very, very strange story, but it's all based on this law. And this was hundreds of years before Moses and the law of Moses was written. This is simply the way tribal societies worked. So the system worked somewhat, but shockingly, it wasn't all that great. Because it assumed a lot of things. First, it assumed that the man would actually do it. And like he might want to, but it might also be really hard and just a huge responsibility. He would have to take on not only the wife, but the kids, any dependents, and all of her debts. So it's very, very expensive to do this. And on the farm, like we said, it was already a real struggle to survive. There's barely enough food for the people that are in your family. Now you have more mouths to feed. So there was never a guarantee. Now imagine you're an older widow. Imagine you're an older widow whose strength is declining and you're way past childbearing days. What chances do you think you have? This is the story of Naomi. Let's go back to verse 1. Ruth 1:1-5. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man from Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. Now, Moab, by the way, let me pause there. Moab, by the way, wasn't just a foreign country, it was a hated foreign country for some reasons that we'll get into when we study chapter 3. What this tells us about the situation, if they're going to go to Moab, a place of essentially their enemies, what does that tell you about how desperate they were? It was bad, okay? They're on the brink of starvation. So where do they go? They go to the last place anyone wants you to go, Moab. Now, by the way, Moab, it was also a tribal culture, so things would have worked in a similar way as far as the Bet Av and how people lived. They would have had different clothings and customs. You would have been able to see the difference between them, but they would have operated in much the same way. Let's continue. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife was Naomi. The names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. Great names there for you guys who are expectant parents. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died and was left with her two sons. Okay, based on what we just read, husband's dead. Is she still okay? Why? Two sons. Okay, so she's still okay, all right? She's got male relatives. Okay, we're good. These sons took Moabite wives. The name of one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth. They lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. Now how's she doing? Not good anymore. Not good anymore. What else do you notice here? Notice that there's no grandchildren. Verse 6. It's getting desperate here. She arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So she's out doing stuff in the fields, and she hears a rumor that Bethlehem, now there's harvest in Bethlehem, so maybe go back, right? She sets out from that place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way, that 50-mile journey, that rocky journey. They are returning to the land of Judah, but Naomi said to her daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband," your mother's husband, your father. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. You guys see what she's telling them? You ladies can return to your father's Bet Av. Go. Go back to your family compound. Please. Your moms are still alive. They'll take pity on you. Let them take you back and provide for you until you can find another husband. And of course, Naomi knows those families wouldn't take her in. What does she have to offer them now? She's declining in strength. She's not going to be able to contribute much to the family's survival. This is not a thing that's going to happen. So when she's telling her daughters to leave, please don't see this as some weird manipulative tactic where she hopes they come along anyway. This is not like, you know, the movies when they say the dog, just go. And they, yay! Anyway, sorry. And they want them to, no, she really wants them to go. All right, verse 10. And they said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands?" See what she's referring to. She's talking about levirate marriage here. That'd be great if she had more sons, but she's like, there's nothing I can do now. I have nothing for you. I have no way to provide for you, to care for you. Please don't come with me. Verse 12, "Turn back, my daughters, go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they are grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it's exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. No, daughters, listen, there's nothing I can do, even if I was going to have kids right now. You were already married for years to my sons and weren't able to conceive. You were married for years and you can't wait for longer. They're way above normal marrying age by now. I have no way to prepare for you. Please stop, for your own sake, go. I need to go back home." You know what annoys me? Is when people look at Naomi in this chapter and they're like, "She's so bitter." Are you kidding me? As she says in the end, "Call me Mara for bitter," and it's like, "Oh, she's complaining. God doesn't like that." I'm like, stop it. You have no idea what you're talking about. This woman was so destitute. She knows what a big deal this is. And they, back then, anything happened, they would say, "Well, the Lord's dealt me a hard blow." Like, they attributed everything to God making something happen. Some people still believe that. I don't happen to believe that, but that's the grid they saw through. So this woman actually has nothing. She has no plan of survival even. She knows it's harvest season and there's some laws about gleaning, so maybe she'll be able to pick up the leftovers after harvest, but harvest season does not last forever. That's a very temporary thing. She has no plan of survival. She's going home to die. A broken woman. Everyone she's ever loved is gone. I think we should have a little compassion for poor Naomi here. Have you ever been that desperate, friends? I would dare say most of us have not been that desperate. I've been desperate, but I've never been that desperate. I have no way to survive. Ruth 1:14. Then they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law. But Ruth clung to her. Ruth clung to her. Can you picture this? Ruth has a way forward. She's going to survive just fine, probably, if she goes back to her father's batav. But she clings to Naomi. And she, being Naomi, said, "See, your sister has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth is not letting go here. Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you." I think she probably took her mother-in-law's face in her hands and said, "Don't, for where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. And your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I shall be buried." You see this? Ruth knows if they go, they're probably going to die. And she's basically saying, "I'll take care of that, and then when I die, I'll be buried right next to you. I will basically choose to be one of your people." Don't see this as a religious conversion. There's nothing in here that suggests this had anything to do with the Torah or the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. This was about her love for Naomi. She might not have known anything about Yahweh. She just wants to be with her. And she says this. Look at this. Look at this covenant. God, this is devotion, you guys. She says, "May the Lord do so to me and more also if anything but death parts me from you." And when Naomi saw this, she was determined, to go with her, she said no more. In other words, she could not talk Ruth out of it. This was not a sweet little, "Where you go, I will go." This was, "Don't you dare keep telling me to leave you, because I'm not. Stop it. I love you and I'm coming with you. And if we gotta die, that's fine." That's devotion. That is devotion. So despite Naomi's best efforts, she can't chase off her daughter-in-law. Isn't that sad that Ruth's speech is only quoted at weddings, pretty much? This is not a wedding speech. It's great. I think it's great to be at weddings. It's beautiful. But it's more of a funeral speech. And that, to me, is even so much more moving. So the two go back to Bethlehem. And we won't reread the rest. We read it last week, but just know when she gets there, the people remember her and they're aghast at what terrible shape she's in. And they say, "Is this Naomi?" She says, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara," because it meant bitterness. She's destitute. But guys, she's not as destitute as she thinks she is, because there's one person who hasn't left her side. Some years back, Sarah and I had just a terrible, terrible week. Won't go into all that happened, but we had been at the hospital all week. I would say it was probably the worst week of our entire lives. And it was so heavy. And I remember driving home, and we were both just an absolute wreck. Felt hopeless, scared, exhausted. And when we stepped into our house, we go into the kitchen, and there's all this food there. And it wasn't just one night's food. It was food for like multiple days. But it wasn't even just that. It was months earlier, I'd had this conversation with some friends joking about how much I love dip. I don't love to dip. No. Dipping chips and I love it. It's like, I don't even almost care what it is. Like the chip then just becomes a vehicle for the queso or whatever, you know, beans, all these things. I just love it. And if that's around, guys, I need help. Like I need accountability to say, "Jason, stop going over there right now." And I was joking with these friends and said, "Yeah, wouldn't it be great to have just meals of just dips?" I came home that day on one of the worst days of our lives, and there were all these meals that were just dips. And I got so emotional because these are my friends saying, "Hey, I know what you're going through, and I'm not going away from you." I'm not leaving. We're there. This is more than just one meal. We're there. I haven't been as desperate as Naomi, but I've been desperate. And having that testimony of people who loved us is one of the most powerful things I've ever felt. To have friends that say, you're hurting. You say you don't want dinner tonight. I don't even care. I'm bringing it. I've had people say that. I've had these people and other friends say that. Stop it. This is not a request. We're bringing you dinner, you big dope. And sometimes it's that dogged friendship that refuses to back off and says, no, I'm coming because I love you. That's exactly what we need. And that is the test of, that's what Naomi had. She thought she was alone and bitter, but she had something so precious. She had a person who was going to step in and be like God to her. You see, this reminds me of Isaiah 49, when God's saying, sing for joy, O heavens, sing for joy. The Lord's comforted his people. He will have compassion on his afflicted. But Zion says this, the Lord has forsaken me and forgotten me. That's what Zion says, right? Just like Naomi, just like I have felt, just like some of you, just like in all societies, the widows, the orphan, the poor, the stranger, the foreigner who comes in and is treated terribly by the home country. All of these things, or maybe just the destitute and brokenhearted. And they're saying, the Lord has forgotten me. But then God responds in verse 15 and says, can a woman forget her nursing child, that she should have no compassion on the son of her womb? The obvious answer is no, probably not. But he says, even these may forget, yet I will not forget you. I am not going to let you go back to Bethlehem by yourself. I am coming with you because that's who I am. That is called covenant faithfulness. That is God saying, yes, I told you I will be with you. I told you I would bless you, and I am going to. And you guys, most of the time when God fulfills that, it is through other people in our lives treating us the way that he's called us to treat one another. This was Ruth being the hands and feet of the God of covenant. And I know a lot of us are in some really tough situations. You don't have to compare yourself to Naomi's destitution. She was on the brink of starvation. They're walking back in a really tough, maybe we're not there, but some of you guys are desperately brokenhearted for any number of reasons. Widows, orphans, strangers, people who have just desperately crying out for their children, people desperately crying out for somebody they love. And God would say to you, it is not the end of your story. You're just in chapter one. It's not the end of the story. My faithfulness is going with you. We're just in chapter one here. And I promise you, he will go with you. He will go with you. He has not left you alone. He will prove himself faithful. And what a gift we have for one another to be the faithfulness of God. To become the faithfulness of God. I will go with you. Jesus, I just thank you for your testimony of this, how clearly you showed this, how clearly you fulfilled all of this. Thank you, Jesus, for never leaving us or forsaking us. Thank you for chasing after us. Thank you that even when we've been faithless, you have remained faithful to your covenant promise. Now, Jesus, I ask you to comfort the brokenhearted, to draw near to those who feel like outsiders, to draw near for those who are afraid for their future, their financial future, for their families, for those who mourn. Jesus, you say you draw near to the brokenhearted. I ask you to do that right now this morning. And may we learn to be men and women of covenant faithfulness like your daughter Ruth. We pray all of this in the mighty name of Jesus, the faithful name of Jesus.